Professor Strauss, Philosophy of Plato, Session 6, April
14,
1965.
And? I think it's harmless.
I suppose. Let us hope so. So, now we will continue our study of the Protagoras. Which point did we reach?
So, Protagoras was about to launch into his first speech.
That is 316 C3, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you remember the situation, I trust. Socrates had given a description of the three groups of sophists, Protagoras, Hippias, and Prodicus, and then, followed by Critias and Alcibiades, he entered the room, and they approached Protagoras, and Socrates confronts Protagoras with a choice: should it be a private or a public conversation? But Protagoras should not make up his mind before he knows the reason why they came. And they, Socrates explains, they come for the sake of Hippocrates, and the only fact he tells him is that Hippocrates comes from a very prosperous house. The other thing is that the reputation of Hippocrates is thought to be a gifted. But Socrates has the impression that he is ambitious, eager for fame in this city. And Protagoras should make his choice between the alternatives, private or public conversation, on the basis of this information about Hippocrates. This was the point we reached last time, I take it. And now we continue at this point, 316C5. Protagoras says first, you correctly take precaution on my behalf. This taking precaution is in Greek a verb from which the name Prometheus is derived. Socrates is a kind of Prometheus, kind of foreseer, providence for Protagoras. And now, will you read them?
Thank you, Socrates, for your consideration of me.
It is a bit more than consideration, taking forethought on my behalf. Yeah.
For your forethought regarding me. For certainly, a foreigner finding his
may
way.
May I add, he doesn't simply say a foreigner or a stranger, but he says an hombre, who is a foreigner, you know. He knows what kind of man he is. It has here the meaning almost which in present day jargon with the word personality would have, or foreign personality. Yes.
Finding his way into great cities and persuading the flower of youth in them to leave the company of others, kinsmen or strangers, old or young, and live with him, under the idea that they will be improved by their association with him,
or literally in order to become better through being together with him. You know, being together, I explained ambiguity already. Yes.
Ought to be cautious, very cautious. Great jealousies are aroused by his proceedings, and he is the subject of many enmities and conspiracies.
Yeah. Now, jealousy, phtonoi, is a plural of the Greek word phtonos, which means envy. Protagoras is thankful to Socrates for his forethought. Men like Protagoras are in danger. We find a reference to their danger also in the Gorgias, which you might consult, 456C to 457B. Protagoras says there, Gorgias says there, rhetoric is a very powerful thing, and therefore distrust it, for it may be used unjustly. But there is no reference to the injustice of sophistry in Protagoras' speech. On the contrary, being together with Protagoras makes those who are together with him better. So, what does he have to fear? Well, precisely this, because people are not merely concerned with their sons becoming better, but they are all very much concerned with by whom, through whom the sons become better. They want the sons to become better through them and not through foreigners or at any rate people other than themselves. There is a passage of this on this subject in Xenophon's Education of Cyrus, Book 3, Chapter 1, Section 38 following. When the company broke up after the evening meal, Cyrus asked Tigranes, an Armenian prince, "Tell me, where is that friend of yours who used to hunt with us, and whom, as it seemed to me, you admired so much?" "Do you not know," Tigranes said, "that my father put him to death?" "And why?" said Cyrus. "What fault did he find in him?" The son: "He thought he corrupted me," the phrase used applied to Socrates in the accusation. "And yet I tell you, Cyrus, he was so gentle and so brave, so beautiful in soul, then when he came to die, he called me to him and said, 'Do not be angry with your father, Tigranes, for putting me to death. What he does is not done from malice, but from ignorance. And the sins of ignorance, I hold, are unintentional.'" And at that, Cyrus could not but say, "Poor soul, I grieve for him." But the king, the father who put him to death, i.e. the man who did to that wise man what the city of Athens did to Cyrus, has spoken his own defense: "Remember this, Cyrus, that the man who finds another with his wife kills him not simply because he believes that he has turned the woman to folly, but because he has robbed him of her love. Even so, I was envious of that man who seemed to put himself between my son and me and steal away his respect." So in other words, Socrates was killed by the fathers because they were envious of Socrates. That is a very important consideration, because it is ordinarily not stated. For example, it's not stated in the Apology of Socrates or elsewhere by Plato, but it is important. Not all fathers were envious, because some of them acquitted Socrates, as you know. But this is an important consideration. And he is here indicated by Protagoras in his own case. A man in Protagoras' position must use caution. This much is clear. Now, if this is so, what would follow for the practical question in hand? Should there be a private or a public discussion? What is more cautious, a private or public? Well, you seem to know, Mr. Levy.
Private discussion is private.
Yes. Now let us see whether that's the conclusion which Protagoras draws.
"Only if it's not known to take place."
And?
"A private discussion, the fact of which is also private."
Yeah, but still, if it is not particularly emphasized, no one else would know that Protagoras had said it should be private. They talk to him privately and he says, "Let us talk privately." No one else hears it. What suspicion could this arise?
Socrates has come up to him in public, said that Hippocrates desires his education, desires to be educated by Protagoras, and says it is for Protagoras to say whether this should be private or public. If Protagoras says it is to be private, then Protagoras is telling everybody else in this whole room.
No,
and Socrates has called them all over.
Oh no, the other people come to them only later. only the surroundings of Protagoras are his adherents. But look at it, not every private conversation is such dangerous. For example, it could very well be that the question of remuneration be discussed, and which is surely properly treated privately, and but in no way to be regarded as dangerously private. Yeah? We do many things only in private without incurring any suspicion. You can figure that out for yourself very well. Now, go on, Mr. Rankin.
Now, the art of the sophist is, as I believe, of great...
You know, that is sweet. I assert... I do not know why they do this kind of thing, because I see no doubt about it. Yeah, I assert, i.e. that is an assertion peculiar to me, that the sophistic art is old. Yes?
Of great antiquity. But in ancient times, those who practiced it, fearing this odium, veiled and disguised themselves under various names, some under those of poets, as Homer, Hesiod, and Simonides, some of mystic initiates and prophets, as Orpheus and Musaeus, and some, as I observe, even under the name of gymnastic masters, like Icus of Tarentum, or the more recently celebrated Herodicus, now of Celimbria, and formerly of Megara.
In other words, a man who changed his domicile, probably because he was exiled. So. Yes.
Who is a first-rate sophist? Your own Agathocles pretended to be a musician, but was really an eminent sophist. Also Pythocleides the Chian, and there were many others. All of them, as I was saying, adopted these arts as veils or disguises because they were afraid of the odium they would incur.
Yeah, one should really translate literally, the envy, and it is envy of the fathers. So, Procorus gives already here by implication his decision. There will be no private conversation because I'm not afraid. Sophistry is an old thing. But the former sophists and some present ones concealed their being sophists because sophistry is hated, distrusted, or an object of envy. Protagoras reveals here 9 men as sophists. Homer is, of course, a leading figure. The central ones are Orpheus and Musaeus, if you account properly. Now, Protagoras, we have seen, was a kind of Orpheus and described as such by Socrates. Yes. So, to repeat, the main point, this was the older sophists, sophists, they see the wide sense of wise men, actually. They conceal their being sophists, they conceal their wisdom because of its dangerous color. And Protagoras does not do it. Why? Yes.
But that is not my way, for I do not believe that they effected their purpose. The authorities in the various cities did not fail to see through their pretense.
More literally, though the powerful human beings, not Andres, not Ombres, the powerful human beings in the cities, yeah, they did not escape. Yeah?
The powerful beings in the areas did not fail to see through their pretense. And as for the people, As for the many, they have no understanding and only repeat what their leaders are pleased to tell them.
No, literally, the many do not notice anything, so to speak. They are just plain dumb. Yes?
Now, to run away without being able to make good one's escape and to get caught is a great folly, and it invariably increases the enmity of mankind.
Of the human beings, you know. You see, the point, the joke here is this. Hombres distinguished from mere human beings, but there is another distinction. Gods and human beings. The hombres are a kind of are almost related to the mass of men as gods are to human beings. The classic passage regarding this distinction is Xenophon's Hero, chapter 7, which you might read. I only hope the translation doesn't ruin these points. Yes?
Now, increases the enmity of human beings. For in addition to his other shortcomings, they regard the runaway as a desperado.
No. In addition to the other, they regard him also as a scoundrel. In other words, the other thing was that they hate him because they are envious of him. But men can be envious of very decent men. And there is no reflection on the character of the man implied if people are envious of him. But in addition, since he uses concealment, he is also regarded as a scoundrel. So concealment of sophistry takes place out of fear of the most powerful men in the city, and who are clever, and therefore the concealment is ineffectual and hence foolish, for it increases the danger. Suspicion on the top of envy. In other words, the wise men of old were mistaken. And Protagoras has this characteristic posture, which we know so well from later times, the contempt for antiquity. These wise men so worshipped and revered are not wise. I am wise. The many do not notice anything. As this is, of course, a harsh statement to make in a democracy, as Athens was at that time. But he could make it safely here because those present are not democrats. You know, that is a kind of a cream. But even the men powerful in the city are only human beings, whereas these wise men of the past are andres, hombres. These things do not come out in the translation. But I thought I should mention. Now, Mr. Schulzke.
Is that true that in fact these men ran into troubles because they were suspected of being sophists? I mean, these men mentioned.
Well, he does not give a proof in any case in any of these cases, but he perhaps he suppressed the examples where evidence of persecution existed. That could be. But he merely, he says it on the basis of his experience. And the funny thing, if I may mention this in passing, is this, that shortly after, Protagoras himself was the object of persecution, and because of his alleged impiety, his books were burned, and he was expelled from others. But let us first, there is, this passage is ironical in that sense that it shows that Protagoras claims to be particularly prudent, and also in making his choice here and now before our eyes, and he is in fact not prudent. Now let us go on where we left off.
Therefore, I take an entirely opposite course, and acknowledge myself to be a sophist and instructor of mankind.
Of human beings, that's very important, not of hombres. Yes.
Such an open acknowledgement appears to me to be a better sort of caution than concealment. Nor do I neglect other precautions. And therefore, I hope, as I may say, by the favor of heaven, that no harm will come of the acknowledgement that I am a sophist.
Yeah, and to speak with God. Yeah, he says that. Now, Protagoras is the first to speak up. And that is indicated by his name, Protos Agorarian. Candor, we see here, is a kind of caution. In other words, it is not simple candor, it is a calculated candor. Yet it is not enough for Protagoras' protection. He needs also other kinds of precautionary measures. And the question is, of course, whether this reference to with God's help is not also part of his precautions. Now let us go on.
And
never forget the fact that shortly after he became himself, all his precautionary measures proved to be inadequate. Yes.
And I have been now many years in the profession, for all my years when added up are many. There is no one here present of whom, in terms of age, I might not be the father. Wherefore, I should much prefer conversing with you about all that, if you want to speak with me, in the presence of the company inside.
Of everyone. Of all who are inside. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Now, in other words, the conclusion is candor, public discussion of everything. But it is not quite public, as you see, Mr. Dry.
Because it's the select company inside.
Sure. Yes, that is a qualified one. How successful Protagoras are, is shown by his longevity. I mean, for 70 years, or almost, he lived till about 70, as you know from another Platonic dialogue, like somebody else. Socrates. He will therefore answer Socrates and Hippocrates' question in public, if only before the indoors public. The irony is this: Protagoras was persecuted on account of impiety, and there is no evidence that the wise men of old were. That's the point you made before. That's quite true. So it shows Protagoras' lack of practical wisdom. One can also say that to emphasize one's candor is to make people doubt one's candor. You probably know people who use the expression, frankly, I do not know, when you ask them about the time. And there are, in most cases, people very little given to candor when they speak of it. And here we have a larger example. About in the Plato's dialogue Theaetetus, 180c to d, we read this: as Socrates approves the way of the men of old, who hid things with the help of poetry, whereas the more recent, wiser men state them openly, so that even shoemakers can learn their wisdom. That refers to the same phenomenon which Protagoras has in mind. One can say, with necessary qualification, this is precisely what enlightenment means, to broadcast the things which previously were preserved of a minority. Yes. And now?
As I suspected that he would like to have a little display and glorification in the presence of Prodicus and Hippias, and would gladly show us to them in the light of admirers, I said...
Love us.
I said, but why should we not summon Prodicus and Hippias and their friends to hear us? Very good, he said.
Yeah. Now, Socrates might have suggested the participation of Prodicus and Hippias anyway. You recall that in 314 B2C he said something about a deliberation with wiser men about whether it is wise for Hippocrates to become the pupil of Protagoras. But Protagoras' vanity makes it compulsory for Socrates to invite this large company. Socrates, as he says here, has come to suspect, on the basis of Protagoras' words, we can make it, have the conversation in front of everyone indoors, that Protagoras prefers a public discussion, not in order to show his frankness, but in order to show off before his competitors. He divines Protagoras' wish, and therefore he says politely, Prodicus and Hippias should listen to us, not to you. Okay. You see how delicate Socrates is? Yes. Yes.
Well, actually, this conversation is not very public because the others are also sophists, aren't they?
Yes, this is what I meant. But there are also Athenians there, you know, non-sophists. I mean, like Callias and like the sons of Pericles and so on. You know, the cream of Athenian society. Where there is a city, you can, like in the 18th century, when a considerable part of the French nobility went along with the philosophes, as they were called at the time, and only through the French Revolution did they learn that this was not wise of them, and then they changed their mind. Yeah? And but the situation is not quite different, because this was not a social movement tending toward a restitution of property. You know, that was very far from it. But we shall see something about the way in which they are threatened very soon. These people of the upper classes. Yes, now let us go on where we left.
Suppose, said Callias, that we stage a regular meeting in which you may sit and discuss. This was agreed upon, and great delight was felt at the prospect of hearing wise men talk. We ourselves took the benches and couches and arranged them by Hippias, where the other benches had been already placed. Meanwhile, Callias and Alcibiades got Prodicus out of bed and brought in him and his companions.
Yes. Yeah. Now you see there is a certain emphasis on Hippias, the benches, rather than on Prodicus, the sphere of the beds or couches. But on the other hand, Prodicus is much more deferentially treated than Hippias. He's brought in by Callias, who is not only the owner of the house, but as it will appear later, the bottle holder for Protagoras, and by Alcibiades, the bottle holder for Socrates. Callias is surely responsible for the comfortable character of the conversation. He asks him to sit down. And the conversation takes place in the region of Hippias, the physicist. They all expect a dialogue between the sophists, not between Protagoras and Socrates. So this, that it will become a dialogue between Socrates and Protagoras is a surprise, because Socrates is not such a famous man as these three sophists are. Socrates is still very young, very young. Yes?
When we were all seated, Protagoras said, "Now that the company is assembled, Socrates, tell me about the young man of whom you were just now speaking."
Now, you see, Protagoras does not want a full restatement of what Socrates had told him privately. Only that part which concerns Hippocrates, not the part dealing with the question, should it be a public or private discussion? One can say, of course not, because this has been said. Now, how does Socrates state now the issue? In public, because previously it was a private statement.
I replied, "I will begin again at the same point, Protagoras, and tell you once more the purport of my visit. This is my friend Hippocrates."
A friend is, of course, not there. Hippocrates here. This here, Hippocrates.
This is Hippocrates, who is desirous of making your acquaintance.
Literally of being together with you. Yes.
Who is desirous of being with you. He would like to know what will happen to him if he associates with you.
If he is with you.
If he is with you.
Yeah.
I have no more to say.
This much, not more, is our speech. Now, this is a repetition of that speech we had in 316 B2C. Now, repetitions in authors like Plato are not like repetitions in a master thesis and many, many other books. There is never a mere repetition, which means never a literal repetition. There is always a deviation, an omission, or addition, or both. And what the changes are in a way more important than what is common to the two or more statements. Now, if we compare these two statements here, we see Socrates omits now the description of Hippocrates. He says Hippocrates here, he doesn't say the other thing. And he adds what he didn't say before: Hippocrates wishes to know what happens to him if he becomes your pupil. Since he omits now the reference to Hippocrates' political intention in particular, it becomes a question what Protagoras will teach him. For after all, he might wish to become a sophist himself, as we have seen. Those who hear only the repetition, what we have read now, must understand Protagoras' answer to apply to all potential pupils, or else they must admire Protagoras' divinatory power, as if he had guessed that this boy is politically ambitious, because Socrates had not told that in their presence. Do you see that point? Good. Yes, go on.
Protagoras answered, "Young man, if you are with me, on the very first day you will be in a position to return home a better man than you came, and better on the second day than on the first, and better every day than you were on the day before."
Yeah. Now what he says at the beginning means more literally Protagoras had taken up or seized, meaning he said in answer. It is not said of him, as it said immediately after what of Socrates, that he had heard or listened. Protagoras replies, as you see, to Hippocrates, not to Socrates. He takes over. You know, Socrates has introduced him, has come as a kind of chaperone, but now he is out of the picture. But Socrates is not so easily be pushed aside. He replies, naturally, for he is the one who acts on behalf of young Hippocrates. Yes. Now the situation is, I believe, now clear. So now everyone knows why Hippocrates came and Socrates came. And Protagoras has given the answer. He educates human beings. That means he makes them better. And the implication is he does this better than anybody else. Otherwise, it would be no interest. Now, what else are you going to say?
When I heard this, I said, "Protagoras, I do not at all wonder at hearing you say this, even at your age and with all your wisdom. If anyone were to teach you what you did not know before, you would become better, no doubt."
No, Socrates deflates his claim immediately. Everyone who teaches somebody else anything makes him better. So this is not an astounding or extraordinary claim. Yes?
But please answer in a different way. I will explain how by an example. Let me suppose that Hippocrates, instead of desiring your acquaintance, being with you, wished to be with the young man Zeuxippus of Heraclea, who has lately been in Athens. And he had come to him as he has come to you, and had heard him say, as he has heard you say, that every day he would grow and become better if he were with him. And then suppose that he were to ask him, "In what shall I become better, and in what shall I grow?" Zeuxippus would answer, "In painting." And suppose that he went to Orthagoras the Theban, and heard him say the same thing you said, and asked him, "In what shall I become better day by day if I am with you?" He would reply, "In flute playing." Now I want you to make the same sort of answer to this young man and to me, who am asking questions on his account. When you say that on the first day in which Hippocrates is with Protagoras, he will return home a better man, and in every day will grow in like manner, in what Protagoras will he be better, and about what?
Yes. Now, Suarez deflates a claim by assuming that better means wiser, and wiser means wiser in an art, in this or that art. Therefore, there is nothing particular about it. Every artisan every shoemaker could rightly say he makes his boy, the apprentice, better every day, maybe better at shoemaking. The examples here are, of course, not shoemaking, but both music and silent. In both examples, the teachers are strangers. But there is the way in which Suarez puts the question is, of course, quite common. But there is one difference from examples we have seen here and in the Gorgias. Do you see that point?
Nothing related to
the
city, no building
art? No, that in the way in which he phrased the question. Well, he does not ask Protagoras to give the answer. In the case of Sisyphus, it's painting. In the case of Protagoras, it is flute playing. He does not put Protagoras to the indignity of having to answer the question what the arts of these two men are. Perhaps because Protagoras is so high, so aloof, that he would not know these two artisans. One of them is still very young. But on the other hand, also it would be improper for Socrates to ask this kind of questions. A personality of the stature of Protagoras. Yes?
When Protagoras heard me say this, he replied...
Now he had heard Protagoras, said not merely, you know. Yes?
You ask good questions, Socrates, and I like to answer a question which is well put.
So now he replies to Socrates, of course, and no longer to Hippocrates. Hippocrates could not have asked him well, put him Carlos, beautifully. So Hippocrates could not have put such questions to him as Socrates could. That goes without saying. Yes?
If Hippocrates comes to me, he will not experience the sort of drudgery with which other sophists are in the habit of insulting their pupils, who, when they have just escaped from the arts, are taken and driven back into them by these teachers, and made to learn calculation, and astronomy, and geometry, and music. He gave a look at Hippias as he said this. But if he comes to me, he will learn only that which he comes to learn. And this is prudence in affairs private as well as public. He will learn to order his own house in the best manner, and he will be able to speak and act most powerfully in the affairs of the state.
Affairs of the city, of course. Yeah. And now you see, he claims to be superior to all other sophists. In a way, he accepts the popular judgment on the sophists, you know, in his way, with the exception of himself. He does not teach arts, for he knows through his private conversation with Socrates, of course, that Hippocrates, what Hippocrates wishes to learn, and these points are and he mentions here only with special emphasis here the mathematics. No mathematics with me, you don't have to worry. Because these are all mathematical arts, as you can see, reckoning and astronomy and geometry and music. Music obviously has the mathematical implication. And you see also the virtue of the narrated dialogue again. This remark that at this point Hippias gave a dirty look in the direction of Hippias could not have been brought out in a performed dialogue, but only in a narrated one. And so there will be nothing of the kind. And what we'll teach from him? Oibulia. This is not sufficiently translated by prudence. it means something more specific. Being well advised, being good at advice regarding the domestic things, so that he can administer his house in the best manner, and about the affairs of the city, so that he will be most able both to do and to say the things of the city. There is a very great difference in what he says of his economic teaching and his political teaching. He doesn't say that he will learn from him to administer the affairs of the city in the best manner. He says it's only regarding his own household. Protagoras does not teach mathematics, we see here also, but only the human things. Like Socrates, according to a popular notion based on quite a few passages in Plato and Xenophon. So, in other words, Protagoras has made clear what it is what he teaches, that it is not clearly not painting, and not flute playing, nor mathematics, nor of course shoemaking, and quite a few other things. It is not an art at all. This being well advised, let us say prudence, let us say prudence. Now, how does Socrates interpret that statement?
Do I understand you, I said, and is your meaning that you teach the art of politics and that you promise to make men good citizens?
Yes, let us stop here. Yeah, here he uses the word hombres, yeah? That he means the political technique, the political art or political science. It is, if this is really a very early dialogue, as people say it is, this would be the first occurrence of the term political science. And we as political science have to respect it properly. So as you see, drops here the distinction between the art regarding the household and the political art, and speaks only of the political art. It is wise for him to drop this reference to the economic art, because the economic art, the art of ruling the household, is of course a monarchical thing, the father, and therefore it is compared very easily with the royal art. The father rules the household in the way in which a king rules the kingdom. Now, but Socrates does makes one claim. Yes.
How about the word that's translated by prudence?
I beg you.
The word that's translated by prudence.
Oibulia, oibulia. Good at giving advice to oneself or others. In other words, it is not in itself the act of practical choice, giving advice. But it can, of course, be easily understood. The Aristotle makes a distinction in the sixth book of the Ethics. He speaks of this particular thing, Eubulia, by itself, and where he makes very clear that there is a difference, but that is not necessarily the Platonic usage, but it is of some interest that Protagoras calls it well-advisedness rather than phronesis, prudence. Yes, Mr. Shaw.
Well, you said that Socrates was wise to drop the discussion of the household side.
Even the mention of it, because because of the monarchic implications.
Well, why does he want to drop monarchic?
We are in Athens, and Protagoras is a stranger, and that will come out very clearly. Socrates wants to help Protagoras a bit, I mean, against unfair attacks. You see that Protagoras' claim, as interpreted by Socrates, is that Protagoras teaches the political art. He does not teach the sophistic art. And also Protagoras teaches an art, whether he likes it or not. And now that is also important, that's the reason why he says now hombres, he-men, or however you're going to translate it, contrary to your contempt for the political leaders, of which he had spoken before, you must regard them as hombres. That's another advice he gives to him. you know, you cannot speak in this contemptuous way here in Athens of the political leaders. Yes, now Protagoras, as you see from his answer, is highly pleased with Socrates' restatement of his claim. Yes?
Well, another thing that Socrates does here is to blur the distinction between, I mean, when Protagoras said what he taught, he teaches the well-ordering of a household and, you know, sort of the way to act and speak well in the city, but Socrates makes him almost say that he teaches the well-ordering of the city, how to make the people good citizens,
in a way,
which
but
isn't what Protagoras said, really.
That is true, yeah, but still, since he had spoken before, that he is educating human beings, and that they become better with being with him, this is not a change. Yes?
Well, but do they become better at being citizens in the sense of being able to well order the city, or do they become better at getting what they
want? This we do not yet know. I mean, there is a certain, that's exactly the point. We do not yet know that, but Protagoras claims to educate human beings. He claims that they become better simply, and that would everyone understand in the sense of becoming, what we would say, morally better. And, but it also politically. So, in other words, he makes them better citizens, better rulers of the city. Yes?
But when he says, what he means by better, Protagoras answers that he means more influential. And Socrates is using
That's something of this kind was meant by Mr. Shumsky, but is this not also a great, great kindness of Socrates to try to prevent him from elaborating this point and to present himself to the Athenians as truly respectable and not only famous in the world?
Well, because the thing is, Socrates usually has some strategy in mind if he does a thing like that. He was never so nice to Gorgias, for example.
But in the case of Gorgias, Gorgias came into trouble immediately because he made this ambiguous statement about the relation of rhetoric to justice. You know, that rhetoric can be unjustly used. Protagoras has said nothing of this kind. These things will come out. And in addition, when Socrates came to Gorgias, there was no young boy like Hippocrates present. These were all mature and old men, you know. His responsibility is much greater here than it is in the Gorgias. Yes?
I'm confused on this, the two senses in which the words referring to humanity or mankind are used, one of which you make a distinction by using hombres. I don't know if you would comment on
that. Oh, then I said, all right, I will repeat it. I will write the book.
I think the nominative symbol, anthropos, human being, anea, hombre. Do you know sufficiently Spanish to understand?
Yes, sir.
It's the only Spanish word which I know. I learned it in one class when I tried to explain what it is. And now, good. So that is very low. You say of a slave, for example, or any inferior thing, it's not. It's only a member of the human species. And you, if philanthropic, the word is derived from that. And it means something like some people like dogs, other like horses, other like birds, and some like these other kids. And so it doesn't have a very high meaning originally. But Cyrus, Xenophon Cyrus, is praised because of his love of human beings, which, as a study of this education of Cyrus shows, was a very meretricious thing. He loved human beings because he needed them so badly in order to become an anea of the highest order. So, now is it clear now?
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, this includes both sexes. And this is limited only to members of the male sex. Do you see that? It's another implication. I hate to say that, but I have to. And now that was it, Mr. Reichen?
Man Mensch is the identical distinction in German, isn't it?
Yeah, but in German when you say das ist ein Mensch, it can mean means more when you say it emphatically than in Latin.
More pejorative?
No, no, more present. Yeah. A true human being. With a heart and, so that is not so simple. Am I not right, Mr. Franke? And that's different. Yeah. Now, yes. And now, so where do we stand now? We know now, finally, and in what, much quicker than in the case of Protagoras, of Gorgias, by the way, what Protagoras' art is, a political art. Well, everyone knows what a political art is. Whereas when we spoke of rhetoric in the Gorgias, no one knew what it was until Socrates made his long speech. So, now let's see how Socrates goes from here. In A8.
Then, I said, you possess a noble art indeed, if you really do possess it. For I will freely confess to you, Protagoras, that I have a doubt whether this art is capable of being taught.
No, wait a moment. For toward you at any rate, nothing else will be said except what I think. Socrates is very frank to Protagoras, he says. Yeah? He would not say everything he thinks to everyone. Is this fine? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Berger. Good. So he's very frank to Protagoras. Now, but is he so very frank? Is he wholly frank? Does he tell Protagoras everything he thinks about him? Well, I think we have some simple proofs that he did not. Yeah. Yes.
His definition, his previous definition of the self, is to Hippocrates.
Yeah, and no, even here when he said, for example, he suspected that Protagoras wanted to show off. He did, of course, not say this to Protagoras. But here one can get an easy way out by saying frankness does not require that you say everything you think, but only that you do not say anything which you do not think. Whether that is good enough is a long question. Yes, now comes Socrates' long speech. Yes.
I have a doubt whether this art is capable of being taught, and yet I know not how to disbelieve your assertion. And I ought to tell you why I am of opinion that this art cannot be taught or communicated by man to man. I say,
in other words, it might conceivably be of divine origin, but it is not a teachable art. Yes.
I say that the Athenians are a wise people. And indeed, they are esteemed to be such by the Hellenes. Now, I observe that when we are met together in the assembly...
Do you see this nice transition? I say that the Athenians are wise. When we assemble, Socrates belongs to this wise group, of course. And
When we are met together in the assembly, and the matter in hand relates to building, the builders are summoned as advisors. When the question is one of shipbuilding, then the shipwrights, and the like of other arts which they think capable of being taught and learned. And if some person offers to give them advice who is not supposed by them to be an expert craftsman, even though he be good-looking and rich and noble, they will not listen to him, but laugh and hoot at him, until either he is clamored down and retires of himself, or if he persists, he is dragged away or put out by the constables at the command of the Prytanes. This is their way of behaving about specialists in the arts.
Not about those
the things which they believe to be susceptible of possible subjects of arts. What they believe to be, not what are in fact subjects of arts. We come back to that.
What they believe to be subjects of specialties, arts. But when the question concerns an affair of state, then everybody is free to get up and give advice. Carpenter, tinker, cobbler, passenger and ship owner, rich and poor, high and low. And no
noble and noble and base.
Noble and base. And no one reproaches him, as in the former case, with not having learned and having no teacher and yet giving advice. Evidently, because they are under the impression that this sort of knowledge cannot be taught.
Yeah, evidently because they do not think this is teachable. Now, Sugarev says then, I do not believe that there is a political art. Such a faculty would have to be of divine origin. This is in a way the foreshadowing of Protagoras' myth following later, but this is not clear from here. You say at the beginning of this speech in B3, he says, I, very emphatically, I as taking him, I, that individual, Socrates asserted, that the Athenians are wise, and of course everyone else says the same, and I, Socrates, happen to belong to them. So therefore he is also, by derivatively, also wise. They do not regard the political art as an art, namely they do not regard it as teachable. Now this is a clear warning addressed to Protagoras. Athens is a democracy. Your very notion of a political art endangers political equality, obviously. If only those who possess the political art are competent to speak or vote on political matters. It's a great question. The public discussion of Protagoras' public subject, namely the political art, must be conducted in awareness of Protagoras' situation here in Athens. You see also a bit later what is important here. This twofold distinction, which is of course as clear today as it was. There are experts and subjects belonging to experts, and political subjects proper, which are not subject for experts. Only the experts can give some advice, but they cannot make as such a political decision. But Socrates doesn't speak here simply of expertise, but of supposed expertise as a condition of participation in supposedly technical deliberations. That is very, very wisely chosen. How can non-experts judge of the extent of the or the domain of an art? How can they do that? Who can know what is a medical question or not competently, except a medical man? That's a great difference. I mean, that we do it, when we say that is no longer a medical question, presume to know what the medical art is. Unless we should be in a possession of a master art, which assigns to every particular art its subject, and if a man possesses that master art, he would of course also know the domains and limitations of every particular art. Now he mentions here, when he speaks of the technical discussions, that here beauty, wealth, and nobility are not considered. Whereas, the indication is they are naturally considered, reasonably considered, in political discussions. Surely, wealth is an important consideration in the political domain, even in a democracy, although it is not legally so, but factually. And nobility, well, old families, I think, still play a certain role, and beauty has this ambiguity. A very attractively looking man has certain advantages which others who are not attractive have, but but it can also refer to the beauty of the soul, yeah, to the gentlemanship. Kalo gagakakatiya. Now in the enumeration of the artisans here, the shoemakers are in the center. The shoemaker, that plays a certain role. Shoemakers, the art of the shoemaker is a protective art. Obviously it protects our feet. And the political art is also protective art. Generals save cities, protect cities. And it is in a way, but it is low, literally, because it protects the lowest part of our body. The shoemakers seem to have played in Athens a role which at least in the world in which I grew up, tailors played, you know. But a pale-faced man sitting at home and lacking the kind of virility which a blacksmith, for example, surely would have. Good. Yes, I believe we can stop here. So clear, the authority of the city of Athens rules out the possibility of a political action. That's clear. Now we come beyond that, because someone might perhaps say cities are not most competent in judging these matters. Yes? Right.
Is Socrates playing a little bit Protagoras here? Because Socrates thrust the term art on him. Protagoras originally claimed, I make him better. And this would be acceptable in a democratic society. We want our children to be nicer. Socrates said, no, you teach them art. And then he said, art, that's undemocratic.
Very good. In other words, we have to take this up later, but since you brought up it, we should at least say a word about it. In other words, if Protagoras were to teach simple, ordinary decency, yeah, he should be highly welcome to any city. The political art is something very different from ordinary decency. And the ambiguity that at one place he means ordinary decency, in other he means a political art, is crucial for the whole argument. But we cannot clear up this ambiguity before we are through. Perhaps we can make a provisional effort to understand it. What is a way leading from ordinary decency to the political art? Do you want to say?
Well,
and everything goes well. Now here natural order has, of course, natural order does no longer mean what it meant before. Natural order means the order derivative from the fact that the man has a higher rank in marriage than the woman. Yeah? If this is it does not mean more than that here. So this is only an example of the fluidity of the of the flexibility of the usage. Now let us turn to page 371, paragraph 3. We must read that whole
paragraph.
I prepare them for the suggestion, and they are right, mature for it. So, yeah, but now we come.